is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Tehran slams the International Atomic Energy Agency after it raised concerns over what it calls covert changes to equipment at Iran's Fordo uranium enrichment plant. The United States shoots down what it calls a Chinese spy balloon that had been flying over American airspace for several days. And thousands of people protest in Tel Aviv for a fifth consecutive week against policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Iran has announced UN nuclear watchdog over its Wednesday report that it raised concerns over changes to equipment at a nuclear site. Iran's nuclear chief, Mohammad Islami, said that the IAEA report is based on a mistake by an inspector during a visit to the Fordo plant. Tehran has written to the agency explaining the inspector's mistake, but agency has publicized the issue. Iranian official criticized the agency's behavior as unprofessional and unacceptable. Islami warned such practices will harm the IAEA's reputation. U.S. and its European allies have issued a joint statement accusing Iran of being inconsistent with its obligations under the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. They say Tehran's response to the agency has been inadequate. Author and journalist Robert Fantina joined us earlier with his take on the IAEA anti-Iran allegations. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
It was the United States, as you said, that destroyed it. The United States that violated the JCPOA. Iran, as I've mentioned before in previous conversations, remained fully compliant with the JCPOA for a full year after the United States reissued the sanctions. Iran was not under any obligation to do that. Once the agreement is violated by one party, then it's null and void, basically. But expecting that the other countries would continue trade and continue to support Iran, the Iranian government gave them a year to do so. And once they ceased doing that, the Iranian government rightly continued with its nuclear program once again. It's the United States that can't be trusted. It's the United States that has violated agreements continually, and it's the United States that should be sanctioned and should be held accountable for its violations of international law.
Iran's top nuclear negotiator says that Tehran is a claimant in JCPOA revival talks, and it's the U.S. and the European allies to make up for their mistakes.
We are the claimant. Then the other side are the Americans. They are the ones who should show their commitment in practice if they want to return to the JCPOA, as they say, and show their commitment to the agreement. And the same goes for the Europeans. It is the Europeans who prove their non-adherence to our nation through various excuses during the period when the U.S. withdrew from the JCPOA.
Bagheri Kani also said, the experience of the JCPOA has taught Iran not to wait for the accord to achieve its goals. It should not rely on foreign powers either. He said the U.S. and its European allies have proved in recent years when it comes to their interests, they don't care about any moral principle. He cited the fact that Western sanctions have impeded Iran's access to food and medicine. The Iranian diplomat, however, said Tehran is still seriously following the sanctions removal talks and hopes the efforts will bear fruit.
The issue has been seriously pursued by the Islamic Republic of Iran and continues to be so. But the opposite party makes false excuses, as before, in pursuit of a series of goals beyond the negotiations. We have repeatedly announced that the Islamic Republic of Iran is ready to continue negotiations within the framework of the previous agreement. And we continue on this path.
Iran rolled back compliance with the nuclear accord after the U.S. withdrew from it and reimposed sanctions against Iran. Tehran and the remaining signatories have held talks on trying to revive the accord since April of 2021. This after the U.S. President Joe Biden took office. Talks have been stalled for months now, though, amid Washington's refusal to provide guarantees. Iran argues an agreement on its revival hinges on the settlements of safeguards issues between Tehran and the IAEA, as well as the removal of all U.S. sanctions. Now, the U.S. says it's shot down what it calls a Chinese spy balloon that's flown across America over the past week. U.S. military said its fighter jets downed the balloon with a missile over the Atlantic Ocean when it floated off the southeastern coast of the country. Military had previously warned that a shoot down over land could risk casualties on the ground. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said the balloon was being used by China to surveil strategic sites in the continental U.S. China, however, said the balloon was for civilian meteorological purposes and had only strayed into U.S. airspace. The incident brought a new low to already tense relations between the two nations. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken postponed his China visit over the incident.
In light of China's unacceptable action.
The Philippines has allowed the U.S. to boost its military presence by giving Washington access to four more bases in the country. The move is part of Washington's attempts to gain strategic advantage over China in the region. Now, Washington and Manila are concerned over Beijing's increased assertiveness that is in the South China Sea. China slammed America's increased military presence in the region as a provocation.
The United States is ramping up its efforts to counter China's growing regional power. Amid Washington's rising tensions with Beijing over the South China Sea and Taiwan, Washington and Manila agreed on plans to accelerate the full implementation of the, quote, Enhanced Defense Cooperation Agreement, with the full agreement to designate four new agreed locations in strategic areas of the Philippines. The deal would allow Washington to deploy military equipment and rotate its troops to four more bases. Washington has currently five bases in the Philippines. The two sides also agreed on the substantial completion of the project in existing agreed locations.
Today, Secretary Galvez and I also reaffirmed our mutual defense treaty commitments. And we'd note that the mutual defense treaty applies to armed attacks on either of our armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft anywhere in the South China Sea or the West Philippine Sea.
According to experts, Washington's access to those bases could provide U.S. forces a strategic position from which to mount operations in the event of a conflict over Chinese Taipei or in the South China Sea. China has criticized the U.S. for its plan to increase its military presence in the Philippines, warning that granting the U.S. greater access to military bases by Manila could hurt regional stability and raise tensions. The move is part of U.S. plans to encircle China's maritime border in anticipation of a war over Taiwan, which Beijing considers as its own. Last year, tensions rose to unprecedented levels after the then U.S. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi visited the island. China has repeatedly warned against any attempt that delegitimizes its national sovereignty. Furthermore, China claims sovereignty over virtually all of the South China Sea, which is also claimed in part by Brunei, Vietnam, Malaysia, and the Philippines. The waters are believed to sit atop vast reserves of oil and gas.
U.S. has also reopened its embassy in the Solomon Islands after 30 years. Move is further attempt on the part of Washington to counter Beijing's growing influence in the South Pacific. NATO is also trying to expand its ties with Japan, also in a bid to counter China.
In another attempt to counter China, the U.S. has opened an embassy in the Solomon Islands after a 30-year absence as it seeks to boost diplomatic relations in the Pacific. The last U.S. embassy in the Solomon Islands closed in 1993. The move comes after China struck a security pact with Solomon Islands last year. It was the first known bilateral security agreement between China and a country in the Pacific. The region has become the center of a geopolitical and strategic tug-of-war between China and the U.S. Meanwhile, NATO, which is a U.S.-led military bloc, is trying to bolster its ties with Japan in a bid to strengthen an alliance against China. The NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg has visited Japan saying the Western military alliance will continue to strengthen its partnership with Tokyo.
Beijing is watching closely and learning lessons that may influence its future decisions. What is happening in Europe today could happen in East Asia tomorrow. So we must remain united and firm, standing together for freedom and democracy.
Japan is a close ally of the U.S., and in recent years, it has expanded its military ties with other Indo-Pacific nations, as well as the United Kingdom, Europe, and NATO. Back in December, Tokyo unveiled a new national security strategy that will see a large increase in its military capabilities. The strategy includes the deployment of long-range missiles. Japan also hopes to ease restrictions on arms export to strengthen its military industry.
Tens of thousands of demonstrators have once again hit the streets of Tel Aviv protesting against the policies of right-wing cabinet led by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Protesters chanted slogans against him and carried banners and signs that read, "Cabinet of Shame and Bring Down the Dictator." Israelis have been protesting against Netanyahu's regime for 5 straight weeks. Protesters are expressing disapproval over what they're calling a fascist cabinet and his proposed reforms meant to increase political power. Now, Benjamin Netanyahu returned to power at the head of a coalition with extreme right and ultra-Orthodox parties. Cabinet is planning to hand over more powers to lawmakers in appointing judges and overriding rulings of the regime's Supreme Court. The coalition also intends to intensify expansionist policy with more settlement units to be built in the occupied West Bank. The Israeli regime has intensified its deadly crackdown on Palestinian in recent weeks. Now, troops stormed Aqaba Jaber refugee camp under the pretext a Palestinian opened fire at an Israeli restaurant. We discussed this issue earlier with our guests in our news review program.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Israeli forces have injured at least 13 Palestinians during a raid in the occupied West Bank city of Jericho, or Ariha. The troops stormed the Aqaba Jaber refugee camp for the 6th consecutive day. They entered the camp with heavy machinery to arrest the Palestinian man that they claim had opened fire on an Israeli restaurant. This is a day after the regime forces attacked the city of Nablus, where they killed a Palestinian. Elsewhere on Friday, they injured dozens of people who were protesting the expansion of Israeli settlements on the occupied territories. The regime has intensified deadly crackdown on Palestinians in recent weeks. 36 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank alone so far this year. Chris Williamson joins us from Derby in the UK. Zafar Bangash, Director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, joins us from Toronto. Gentlemen, welcome. I'd like to start with you, if I may, Chris, taking a look at perhaps something that is quite, I don't want to use the word shocking, but it was quite unbelievable to see the U.S. Secretary of the State, Anthony Blinken, in the area and the reaction that he had in terms of the press conferences that we saw. Because if you were to take those press conferences with his presence out of the context of what's happening on the occupied territories, you would think it's just any other day, based on the way that he responded to what is happening. Are we looking at how would you categorize the U.S. role when it comes to the way that things are back to status quo for Israel on the ground in occupied Palestine?
Well, frankly, I don't think that Israel could conduct itself in the way that it does without the tacit approval of the United States of America. And it's therefore really important, I think, that people on the ground in the States, and indeed across the world, actually, highlight the daily atrocities that the Zionist regime are actually perpetrating on the Palestinian people. And I speak to people in the States on a regular basis, and there is a growing dissatisfaction, frankly, with the blank check that the United States administration are giving the Israeli regime to just carry out these appalling actions on a routine basis. And furthermore, I think people in the States are getting increasingly concerned about the fact that whilst they have no Medicare for all, while under virtually every bridge in every state in the country, people are sleeping on the streets. People can't afford to get an education because that leaves people with massive debts. And yet, they are prepared to shell out £4 or 5 billion every single year in monetary aid, military aid, to the Israeli regime. And I think people are getting increasingly sick of this. And there is now in the United States a third party which is gaining ground. And yeah, I think politicians will start to take note. I hope they do, certainly anyway, in the United States, because the groundswell of opposition, I think, to the position that both parties have taken is actually beginning to lose patience with the direction that the states have allowed the Zionist regime to go.
One of the things that also stands out this past week, Bangash, I don't know if you caught the interview that one of these American channels had with Prime Minister Netanyahu, where amongst many shocking statements, one of them was, don't get hung up on peace with Palestinians. Let's go from the outside in. Again, I don't know if you caught that interview, but what do you make of that statement and stance that Netanyahu has vis-a-vis the Palestinians?
Well, it makes absolutely clear that the Zionists are not interested in any peace in any shape or form. The policy that they have been pursuing for decades, and that policy has now intensified since the new, even more extreme cabinet was cobbled together at the end of December, clearly indicates that the Zionists have escalated their violence against the Palestinian people, and what they want to do is to crush the resistance completely, to ethnically cleanse the Palestinians, and that is what we witness in terms of the massive settlement activities that are taking place or have been authorized on the occupied West Bank, and also the very, very frequent encroachments on Masjid al-Aqsa compound. These are all indications that the Zionists do not care for any peace, and they are going to use whatever force necessary. And they've got a blank check from the Americans and other of their Western allies who really don't care for Palestinian lives. And so this policy of brutality will continue. And Netanyahu simply confirmed that in his television interview that, forget about peace with the Palestinians. That means this was a clear admission and indication that his regime is going to continue with this brutal policy of killing the Palestinians.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you very much to both of you. Chris Williamson, host of Palestine Declassified from Derby, UK, and Zafar Bangash, director of the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought from Toronto. Thank you. With that, we come to an end for this edition of the News Review. Thanks for tuning in.
And that's it for your latest, everyone. Thank you for joining us here on World News.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. a non-governmental group in the United States that closely monitors the violence of the police in the United States, has reported that last year the U.S. police had a record of killing people, especially black people, as they killed an average of more than 3 per day. Every year in the United States, about 1,000 citizens are victims of police brutality and die from police shootings. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Officials said on Monday, 30th of January, 2 more Memphis police officers have been disciplined and 3 emergency responders fired in connection with the death of Tyre Nichols. That brings the total number of officers who have been disciplined to 7, including the 5 police officers who were fired and charged recently with second-degree murder and other offences in Nichols' beating and January 10 deaths. According to multiple reports, the Memphis police major, Karen Rudolph, said on Monday, 30th of January, police officer Preston Hemphill was relieved of his duty and put on what is known as administrative leave. Later on that day, it said another police officer has also been relieved of his duties, but without naming the person or specifying what role they played in the incident. Memphis Police Major Karen Rudolph stopped short of saying what role Hemphill had at the scene of Nichols' deadly beating or whether he would be charged with a crime in connection with the killing, as several other police officers have been. But Karen Rudolph said that the investigation into Nichols' death continues and more information will be shared as it develops. In a statement, police said all 7 police officers have been relieved of their duties on 8th of January. Also on Monday, fire department officials announced the firing of the emergency medical technicians Robert Long and Michael Sandridge and Lieutenant Michelle Whitaker in connection with Tyre Nichols' death. The Memphis Fire Chief Gina Sweet said in a statement that her department had received a call from police to respond to a report of a person who had been pepper sprayed, and the workers arrived as Tyre Nichols was handcuffed and leaning up against a squadron car. The statement said Long and Sandridge, based on the nature of the call and information police gave them, failed to conduct an adequate patient assessment of Tyre Nichols. Michelle Whitaker and the driver remained in the vehicle. The statement said an investigation determined that all 3 had violated multiple policies and protocols. Officer Hemphill was the 3rd police officer at the traffic stop that preceded the violent arrest, but was not at the scene where Tyre Nichols was beaten. Lawyers for the Nichols family asked on Monday why the department had not disclosed disciplinary action against Officer Hemphill earlier, and why he had not been fired or charged. News of the additional police officers' removal comes as calls for changes to American policing intensify after Tyre Nichols' death. The chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus, Stephen Horsford, said the group of 60 members of Congress had asked to meet with the president in the coming days to push for negotiations on much-needed national reforms to our justice system, specifically the actions and conduct of our law enforcement. The appeal to President Biden, who has called on Congress to pass police reforms, came as protests prompted by Nichols' killing continued in Memphis, Tennessee over the weekend. Tyre Nichols, who was black, died on 10th of January, just 3 days after Memphis police officers beat him after a traffic stop. Tyre Nichols' parents, who have been invited to attend, President Biden's State of the Union speech on 7th of February said the 29-year-old was driving home after photographing the sunset. Video footage released by Memphis officials last week showed police officers kicking and punching Ty Nichols and hitting him with a baton. CNN's website has also covered the story and tells us more. The attorney representing the Nichols family, the family of Ty Nichols, a 29-year-old black man killed by Memphis police recently, has called on Congress to use this tragic death to pass reform legislation to rein in the epidemic of police brutality in America. Ben Crump, the attorney representing the Nichols family, said, "Shame on us if we don't use this tragic death to finally get the George Floyd Justice in Policing Act passed." Ty Nichols' death had sparked protests across the United States and rekindled the debate about the need to change the culture of police violence in the country. Ben Crump said, "It is this culture that says it doesn't matter whether the police officers are black or Hispanic or white, that is somehow allowed for you to trample on the constitutional rights of certain citizens from certain ethnicities and from certain communities." Members of Congress said on Sunday, 29th of January, they need to revive their effort to pass substantial police reforms. The chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Dick Durbin, a Democrat of Illinois, acknowledged that while police officers purportedly risk their lives for Americans every day, some of the same officers are engaging in horrible conduct. He told ABC's This Week program, "What we saw on the streets of Memphis, Tennessee was just inhumane, horrible. I don't know what created this rage in these police officers that they would congratulate themselves for beating a man to death, but that is literally what happened." Dick Durbin said he would not rule out a federal investigation into the Memphis Police Department following the violent encounter with Ty Nichols. According to academics and advocates for police reform who track such deaths, nationwide, police have killed roughly 3 people per day, consistently since 2020. Police reform talks, spurred by the death of George Floyd at the hands of a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, collapsed in Congress in 2021, after lawmakers failed to strike a bipartisan deal. CBS News has also covered this story and tells us more. More protests have erupted across the United States, including in the city of Memphis, Tennessee, against the killing of the young black man by the Memphis police, with protesters marching and blaming the U.S. government for the rising violence against the black community and saying the system is murdering us. Thousands of people have marched through the streets of Oakland, California, to protest police brutality and systemic racism against minorities, and to demand justice for young black man Ty Nichols. The protest rally was organized by the Anti-Police Terror Project. Speakers at the rally included family members of residents who were killed by police. They strongly condemned the violence against people of color in America. Kat Brooks, executive director of the Anti-Police Terror Project, which organized the event in Oakland, California, said, "What happened to Ty Nichols is not an exception, it's the rule, and it happens every single day in this country. This is what American policing looks like." People from around San Francisco Bay Area joined in the protest to express their outrage at the U.S. police killing of blacks and other minorities. Brianna Vieira, who lives in San Jose, California, was quoted as saying, "Obviously, we're here to collectively grieve Ty Nichols' brutal murder and to stand in solidarity with the Memphis community." Police violence against African Americans and Asian Americans in the United States has assumed alarming proportions in recent years, creating fear and panic. In May of 2020, following the Minneapolis police killing of George Floyd, mass protests erupted in the United States against police brutality and systemic racism. Protests and demonstrations took place in many U.S. cities and spread to even beyond America's borders. The 46-year-old, George Floyd, was killed by a white police officer who was kneeling on his neck. Video recording of the killing showed the former killer cop Derek Chauvin pressing on George Floyd's neck for more than 9 minutes as the victim begged for mercy. The video clip went viral, triggering mass protests throughout the United States and the wider world.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, and our heartiest congratulations to you all on the blessed birth anniversary of the gateway of the City of Knowledge, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. Let us reflect on food for thought as bequeathed to us by the only person who was born in God's symbolic house, the Holy Kaaba in Mecca. O people, beware of fondness of this world, because it is the head of every sin, the door to every misfortune, the companion of every sedition, and the caller to every disaster.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, ways of self-building. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the ways and the paths of self-building in the Islamic lifestyle. Well, when we talk about the self-building, the very first thing that we need to bear in our minds is to ponder where we are, to analyze ourselves in order to perform the self-building. The second thing is to have the firm determination of following the teachings of Islam, the determination of following the teachings of Ahlul Bayt and Quran, inshallah. The third thing that we need to have is to condition with ourselves. The condition is that I condition myself to not to perform any kind of evil or sin during the day. I promise myself to not to follow the path of evil. And this promise that I'm making to myself on the daily basis is taking me towards the perfection, is taking me towards the pure Islamic lifestyle. And therefore, it is necessary sometimes, you know, when we promise ourselves, for example, we have seen some people who are on diet, they promise themselves that I will avoid, for example, the cola, I will avoid the soda, I will not take this, I will avoid the, for example, mayonnaise or ketchup or the things that have more fats in them. So they promise themselves and they try to live their life according to that. And if you offer them something like that, they say, I have promised myself because I want to lose some weight. Therefore, it is necessary in the Islamic lifestyle as well to promise ourselves on the daily basis, to remind ourselves on the daily basis that we will not follow the path of evil. We will not follow the path of shaitan. We will not perform any kind of sins during the day, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z. We were talking about the topic of ways of self-building in the Islamic lifestyle. We said that there are different ways that we can have the self-building, and one of them was conditioning ourselves. That was the third way. The fourth way of self-building is muraqibah. Muraqibah means to take care of ourselves, to take care of the deeds, the actions that we perform. You know, sometimes we perform the things and after that we forget about that. The meditation can help us, this muraqibah or meditation can help us keep ourselves on the level in which we are. We need to take care of ourselves. Obviously, when I'm doing something, when I'm performing good deeds, shaitan is after me, evil is there. My nafs-e ammara, the nafs which orders to perform the evil, it is there. So the outside enemies are there, the external enemies are there, my friends maybe, or the media, or the environment in which I'm living, especially people living in the West. So you can see everywhere there are many different means which takes us towards the evil. So therefore, I need to have this meditation. I need to be careful that once I have promised myself not to perform any evil, then I'm taking care of myself. I am guarding myself. I become the guard and the protector of myself, my soul, and I do not let my soul or thoughts to be hijacked by anyone. So this is the other way. And the last way of having the self-building is known as muhasibah. And the muhasibah is self-calculation. We need to compute ourselves. We need to calculate or compute or perform some computation over our actions that we do during the day. At the night before sleeping, just think what I have done during the day. If it was in accordance to the orders of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, then say thanks to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If it wasn't, then ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala for the help so that He helps us that tomorrow we do not repeat the same mistakes that we did today, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Self-assigned mission.
There's no mistaking what this, in fact, really is. It's a massive voice of protest against the rule of the Shah.
Good evening. Now we know the United States has passed the word to the Shah of Iran. It's time for him to leave his country.
The political initiative now lies totally with the Ayatollah. Now that he's back, he'll very soon announce the establishment of a government of his own.
There might have been tears in the eyes of the Shah as he left Iran for what could be the last time. There was nothing but sheer delight on the faces of the demonstrators who took to the streets of the capital in their thousands to celebrate the departure of the man they have hated for so long.
So I set out to try and find out for myself exactly what had happened there. I have no sympathy for the regime in Iran, or for any political regime for that matter. So when the book finally came out, it was met by silence, which of course is the most devastating critique. Up until the age of 20, I lived in the United States. I grew up in Los Angeles, which is one of the largest cities in the US on the West Coast. And learned there some basic lessons about life, but essentially grew up in profound ignorance, which of course is the lot of most Americans. 78 and 79, I became aware, like many people in North America, of the nature of the previous regime in Iran, the Shah's regime. And having certified that it was in fact a despotic, cruel, and tyrannical regime, I joined Iranian exiles here in Montreal, in marching in the streets and educating myself about the realities of Iranian history. So when the Islamic Revolution occurred in 1979, I was powerfully struck by it. First of all, I was delighted to see that the tyrant had fallen, had been overthrown by a mass movement, truly a mass movement, unparalleled, almost unparalleled in the century, where millions of people came into the streets and said the Shah must go. So I set out to try and find out for myself exactly what had happened there. What was peculiar in Iran, and what did Islamic Revolution mean? I was familiar with the French Revolution, with the Russian Revolution, the Chinese Revolution. These were somehow social events depicted as social and political revolutions. But here was one that cast itself in religious terms. So like anyone else who was serious about dealing with these issues, I had to, first of all, confront my own ignorance to try to overcome it. How do you do that? By reading and by seeking experience. And also by trying to find out for yourself on the spot what happened. And over time, these self-assigned missions, as I said, became more and more complex. Some resulted in newspaper articles. A couple of resulted in books, and a few of them resulted in films, on which I collaborated with a colleague of mine, Jean-Daniel Lafont, who was a leading Quebec filmmaker. Since that first time, which was in 1983 or 84, actually the date escapes me, I think it was 84, I've been back 30 times. I had accumulated notebooks full of things that I had seen and heard, not all of which can be published in the Daily Press. So I said, what am I going to do with this? Sit on it, or am I going to try to make some use of it? So I did. I transformed these notes into a book which described what I saw, heard, smelled, felt when I was in Iran, not only in Tehran, but visiting other cities as well. There's a section here about actually my first encounter with Iran. I could read that if you wish. When the Shah fell and fled in mid-January 1979, Western media greeted the transformation with guarded optimism. Only a few months had elapsed when these same media began to revile the man who had brought low the tyrant. To judge by its unanimity, their conclusion might well have been dictated by some shadowy central agency. When compared with other massive popular upheavals of the modern era, like the French, Russian, or Chinese revolutions, the change of regime in Iran looked more like Mao Zedong's Tea Party than Lenin's Festival of the Oppressed. There could be only one way to get to the bottom of this. I would have to see for myself. Not only would I attempt to visit the Islamic Republic, if I managed to get there, I would testify as a reporter to what I found. That all this actually took place, as I look back upon it, seems only slightly less astonishing than the original ambition, no, the pretension itself. The thing that I found attractive about the atmosphere was still present. The intensity, the commitment of individuals who have deep political and or religious beliefs, despite the fact that they found themselves a minority, all of those things were present. I was fortunate because I fell in with people who had that strong sense of commitment to building a better, more egalitarian society in Iran. So I found that. I found that Iran has emerged since the terrible days of the war with Iraq into a thriving modern society with a relatively, in fact, very high level of culture, economic development, prosperity for some. The bitter poverty that I saw, I won't say has disappeared, but it's much more difficult to find. So Iran has emerged. Never was anything I wrote about Iran changed or censored. Striking. I developed a relationship with La Presse, and particularly with certain people at La Presse, who appreciated what I was doing, because I was giving them the kind of reports that they could not find from the wire services, from the international press services, and so on. Could not find. I was writing with names, photographs, times, places. These are real individuals with whom I spoke, and this is what they said. It was an interesting case. I would come back from Iran, I would write 4,000 or 5,000 words, they would be published untouched. Absolutely remarkable. And when I wrote the books that I wrote about Iran, the same thing. Nothing I wrote was challenged or censored. Just like we say, beauty is in the eye of the beholder, truth is also in the eye and the ear of he or she who reports it. So often the account of an event that I would produce would not at all be the same as the account that a news agency journalist would produce, that an Iranian journalist would produce because he would be working under certain constraints, that a French journalist would produce, and so on. But during the years that I frequented Iran, I saw an immense variety of viewpoints, some of which had to struggle to make themselves heard, but they had a constituency. That's what I wanted to reflect in my reporting. And I think I did it fairly. I have no sympathy for the regime in Iran, or for any political regime for that matter, but I have immense sympathy for Iran as a culture and as a people. Immense. This book is something that old men do, which is to tell the story of their lives. This is the way we hope to avoid disappearing totally when we are physically no longer present. And it's an attempt for me to come to grips with events that took place in my life that shocked and transformed me, particularly the death of my younger brother, which occurred 32 years ago, and which was somehow the key moment in my life. And what I attempted to do in this book, is to link the story of his death, which occurred by his own hand, with the way we were brought up as young men in the United States, trained to accept the American imperialist system, not to argue about the imperative for war and aggression that's somehow part of the American psyche. Early on, I became aware, although indistinctly, of the nature of, you might say, American civilization or American culture. I found that I had to struggle against it and ultimately to reject it, although it took a long time to articulate how I would do that. My first step was to refuse to serve in the U.S. Army and to refuse to go to Vietnam, which is why I left the United States and established myself in Canada. My brother was not so fortunate. For whatever reason, he was unable to leave, entered the Army, experienced terrible things, and as a result of that, ultimately brought his life to an end. For this, I do not blame him, nor our family upbringing, but I do blame the broader circumstances of American culture that allowed this mindset to shape and to distort the life of our family. Not only of our family, the family, hundreds of thousands of people. And of course, we're still living, we as citizens of the world, with this monstrosity today. It's truly a monstrosity. How can a society say, we will take upon ourselves to make a moral judgment about the right to survive, to live, or to die of those around us? Who are we? These are the kind of questions that I wanted to ask and that I do ask in this book, and I try to connect the way an individual brings his life to an end and another one continues on his life with the nature of that society, the way it shaped a family, the way it shaped us, and how we struggle to emancipate ourselves from it. The events that took place in Iran in 79 and 80, as I said before, set me off on the path which eventually led me to discover Islam in a profound way, and finally to become a Muslim, alhamdulillah, as we say. I don't know whether that particular argument is germane to the chat that we're having. Perhaps it's of interest to your viewers, I don't know. But what was crucial is the confluence of these two events, a tragedy and an awakening. That's the story of this book. The title of which is Then We Were One. Originally, you can see by the cover which shows two little boys, there were two. After that, there was one, the survivor who is myself, who's telling the story. The lady who was the spokesperson for the students who captured the U.S. Embassy in 79, Khanoumeh Masoumeh Imtekar, with whom I became very close. And with her wrote a book about the capture of the embassy from the Iranian point of view, the only book ever published from the Iranian point of view on those events. The version, the doubt was that of the hostages themselves. But thanks to the existence of this book, which we did together, no responsible person can say, we don't know what the Iranian point of view is. It's there, and it is the responsibility of a journalist who, if he wants to write, or a historian, if he wants to write the story of those days, to find that book and to quote it. So when the book finally came out, it was met by silence, which of course is the most devastating critique. Generally speaking, there are noble exceptions, but generally speaking, we have a party press, especially in the United States, Europe, and Canada. not in the sense that of the former Soviet Union, when the Communist Party dictated what was in the newspapers and on television, but in the sense where it would be inappropriate for you as a journalist or as a publisher or as an editor to disagree with what the political line of the White House is. This was immediately visible after the events of September 11, 2001, where people were told to watch what they say, and the meaning was clear. If you want to keep working, be careful. No one was going to die or be put in prison yet. But if you want to keep working, watch yourself. One. Two, the mass media are concentrated, extremely concentrated, in the hands of a few powerful individuals, many of whom, by the way, are Zionists. This is not to hold a racial position. This is to hold a political position, make a political analysis. So with regard to events in the Middle East in particular, not only Iran, but to, generally speaking, the Arab world and what we might call the greater Islamic world, this cannot only be attributed to ignorance. This can be attributed to, as far as I'm concerned, a political, cultural, and social agenda. What exactly that agenda is, difficult to determine at this point. Some say it's the consolidation of the U.S. empire, universal hegemony. And I believe that the current U.S. administration believes that. They won't say it, but I believe that's what they think. But if I say that publicly, people will laugh at me and say, oh, you're a conspiracy theorist. So I won't say that publicly. I'll just allude to it in our friendly chat here. It would be wrong to say that there is total unanimity in, say, the United States or in the West about the necessity of attacking Iran over its so-called nuclear program. There are those who are arguing powerfully for it, say we must attack Iran, must attack before they do this and do that, before they incinerate the entire world. I note parenthetically that Germans have just furnished Israel with nuclear-powered submarines, which have a missile launch capacity, and in which the Israelis can install their atomic warhead missiles. Okay, this is parenthetically. Not much is made of that. So who has the actual capacity now to attack another country with nuclear weapons? Not Iran. But somehow Iran is the threat, because maybe it will think about doing that at some point in the future. All of the Iranian authorities have said, we have no intention of doing so, and it's un-Islamic to produce and to use these devices, which I agree with. But there are voices, honorable, honest voices, in the American media landscape, which say, no, you're liars. In fact, Iran must be judged as any other nation must be judged on the basis of what it does, not what it might do. Just as if I were to make a judgment about you, for instance, I would examine what you've written and what you've said and say, well, okay, this is what I think. But it would be unfair of me to say, because you're an Iranian person, at some point you might become violent with me. This is what they call the 1% theory. There's 1% possibility that maybe at some point in your life you would do something inimical to me. Therefore, I can hit you now. I was fortunate enough, after becoming acquainted with Iran, going there several times, to go there during Ashura, which is the month in the Islamic calendar where Shia support the martyrdom of Imam Hussein. I became acquainted with the story of Hussein, with his rendezvous in Karbala, with the forces of oppression, and with the power of his action. Here's a man who categorically says no to injustice and marches out against it, although he knows that he will be defeated. And yet that position of principle was more important to him, far more important to him than his life. Far, far more important. What are the priorities that we have in our lives? Yes. So if you're sensitive to the question of justice and how it works itself out in the world, how could you not be moved and drawn to the example of Imam Hussein? But from that time until the time that I actually accepted Islam formally, how many years passed? 28 years passed. a very slow progression. This is not somebody who says, on the spur of the moment, a great light comes down and I become a convert. No, that didn't happen. It was deliberate, cautious, asking questions, resisting. The American Muslim Jeffrey Lange has written an